If you were to swallow a small amount of plutonium, it would prove less toxic than the caffeine in your morning coffee. But stand next to the wrong piece of it and you could be dead within weeks. Physicist Jeremy Bernstein explains its unusual characteristics in his latest book, Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. It's published by Joseph Henry Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jeremy Bernstein back to my show today. Hello. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Good to see you again, Leonard. I was here a number of years ago. And that time you told me that Al Sears, the saxophone player whom I knew in high school, had just died. And Big Al Sears was Duke Ellington's saxophone player. And now, some years later, we're talking about an element that can kill us all. Let me just, if you don't object, correct what you just said, because the true situation is almost exactly the opposite. Namely, swallowing milligrams will kill you, and holding it will not kill you. I myself held the pit of a nuclear weapon, plutonium pit of a nuclear weapon. I'm still here. Plutonium is an alpha particle emitter, and like polonium-210, and has the same kind of properties as far as killing anybody. And alpha particles are very difficult to get through the skin. But if they get inside you, they can do an awful lot of damage. So that's I think, the thing to worry about. Don't eat any.
Well, you were an intern at Los Alamos, so you probably have been thinking about plutonium for a long time.
Well, you know, the strange thing is that I didn't. It's really strange. I taught nuclear physics courses. I never remember teaching anybody about plutonium. But I got into it kind of by a back road when I started studying the German nuclear weapons stuff, and learned that there was a rogue program. In which they actually tried to make a bomb. And Weizsäcker, who was in the program, just died, actually, a week or so ago, actually took out a patent on the use of what we would call plutonium for making a nuclear weapon. And when I started studying that, I realized I didn't know anything about this, about plutonium. I thought I'd better learn about it. So I looked for a book which might teach me about it. I couldn't find one, so I said, well, Jesus, maybe I better write one.
It's been said that plutonium led to the speedy conclusion of World War II, but only one of the bombs dropped on Japan was made with plutonium.
The other one was with
uranium. So is one superior to the other as something that will kill lots of people?
Well, the uranium bomb was the Hiroshima bomb, and that was less powerful than the Nagasaki bomb, which was a plutonium bomb. Plutonium uses less material than a uranium bomb. You don't have to enrich it or separate the isotopes. So once you master the chemistry of extracting the plutonium from the uranium in a reactor, then it's the way to go.
But when we talk about North Korea or Iran getting nuclear weapons, we're talking about enriched uranium, not plutonium.
No, there are two different cases. North Korea uses plutonium. They have a reactor, Yongbyon, which they have made enough plutonium, depending on how smart you think they are, for something like maybe 10 bombs, but depending how smart you think the design are, is the one they blew up some months ago, which was apparently a fissile, was a plutonium weapon, and it shows that they were not quite there yet. The Iranians are into the uranium business, and they're separating uranium isotopes. They're trying to construct a reactor with the help of the Russians, which would make plutonium if they were able to construct it. I don't quite understand what's going on, because the Russians claim the Iranians haven't paid, and Iranians claim they have paid. So exactly what's going on, I don't quite know.
How does a nuclear bomb actually work? And why is plutonium better than enriched uranium?
Well, there are two kinds of nuclear bombs. Basically, the way they all work is that you take a fissile element, one which can be fissioned with neutrons of any energy, and you start with a subcritical mass configuration, and you very rapidly produce a critical mass configuration. In the case of the uranium bomb, what you do is you take basically uranium shell and you shoot it into uranium target, and this assembles the critical and supercritical mass. But it's slow by these standards. It takes a few milliseconds. With a plutonium bomb, you do it with implosion. You have a plutonium sphere. You put high explosives around it. You compress the sphere in the order of a microsecond, and then that produces the supercritical mass.
It falls in on itself, and
It gets compressed. You cannot, with plutonium, use the gun assembly method because of what's called spontaneous fission. So the people at Los Alamos were forced to use this implosion method. And once you master it, it has a lot of advantages. It uses less material and is really a much more efficient kind of weapon in the end.
Now, the spontaneous fission means that if you you stuck it all together in a certain way, it would just go off by itself?
No, what happens is that these very heavy elements like plutonium, uranium, and so on really are on a knife edge between stability and instability, and they easily can spontaneously break apart. And when they do, they fission into lighter elements and neutrons. And it's the neutrons which can start the chain reaction. So if you have too many neutrons floating around from the spontaneous fission, you start the chain reaction. With the implosion weapon, the critical assembly occurs so fast that it doesn't really matter that the neutrons are floating around. So that's sort of the essence of it.
And fission is a key factor in all of this. If it hadn't been discovered, then all of the rest of this wouldn't have happened?
Right. Fission is absolutely the sine qua non for everything. I mean, a hydrogen bomb works by starting off first a fission bomb. So fission is absolutely the first step. And
Otto Hahn got credit for discovering fission and won the Nobel Prize, but many people have said there were all sorts of other scientists who should have gotten some of the credit.
Well, I would say not all sorts. First of all, Hahn had a collaborator in Germany named Strassmann, who was a very courageous anti-Nazi, and he certainly should have gotten something. And then Hahn didn't understand what he discovered. That was explained to him by Lisa Meitner and her nephew Otto Frisch on the famous walk they took in Sweden in this Christmas of 1938, where Meitner had these letters from Hahn saying, look, I have this thing. I don't know what it is. What is it? And according to the story, which I love, I don't know if it's true or not, they took a walk in the woods in Sweden in Christmas 1938, and then they sat down in a tree trunk, and the two of them figured out what it was. The part of the story that I don't believe is that they had the paper and pencil do the writing on the tree trunk. The rest of it I believe.
My guest is Jeremy Bernstein, and his latest book is called Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. Mr. Bernstein was for 35 years on the staff of The New Yorker, the author of 13 books. This is the 13th?
You know, I really don't know.
Because you wouldn't want plutonium to be the 13th, would you?
Not really, but there's a 14th that's coming out in the fall, which is on nuclear weapons in general. I don't know whether one wants that to be the 14th or not. But
why do you start the history of plutonium with the story of the periodic table?
Well, because I'd like to explain to people how plutonium fits in the periodic table. And it comes two elements after uranium. It's got very complicated properties individually and collectively. And I just thought it was important to give the story of the periodic table and to explain how plutonium fits in. And now it didn't fit in earlier. So I found that interesting. But, you know, I'm a physicist, so I find things interesting that many people don't.
How are uranium and plutonium related if they're two steps away from each other?
Right. They're both part of what's called the actinide series. And the actinide series is a series of elements that begins with actinium and goes through things like californium and fermium. And all these elements have similar properties. Plutonium is the strangest of them all. It doesn't seem to know what it wants to do. So it has six of what are called allotropic phases. You know about allotropic phases, although you don't think you do, because carbon has two of them. One of them is graphite and the other is diamond. And these are phases of crystal phases of the same element, but with very different crystal structures. And plutonium has six, which was something that was discovered during the war. And it was also found out that the phase that's stable at room temperature it doesn't act like a mineral. My metal acts more like a glass. So what had to be done is they had to go to the delta phase and then amalgamate it with gallium to make something that worked.
What does it look like?
Oh, dear. Well, plutonium is a sort of a silvery thing, but it oxidizes very quickly. And when it oxidizes, it turns different colors depending on what the environment is. When you say what is the color, it depends, I think, a little on the environment.
Does it occur naturally, or
No.
is this something that has to be manufactured?
No, it's all manufactured. It's all manufactured. Now it's basically all manufactured in reactors. The first manufacture was in a cyclotron by Seaborg in February 1941, but it's an artificial element.
Although scientists who worked with plutonium originally thought that they'd found the last element on the periodic table, didn't they realize that they could just keep on doing this and add more and more?
I think they did. And then when they started testing these bombs in the atmosphere, down in the fallout there came these heavier elements like californium and fermium and other ones. So
they had created them through the explosion.
They created them through the explosion. They produced a lot of neutrons, and the neutrons interacted with plutonium and produced these heavier elements.
And how? So you need uranium to then go through some kind of a process, a fission process, to create plutonium.
Right. Well, actually,
how is that different than enriched uranium?
Yes, enriched uranium involves isotopes of uranium, in this case 238 and 235. And what you have to do there is to separate the isotopes. And the isotopes both have the same chemical properties, so you have to separate them using the very small mass differences, which is why the Iranians are so pleased with their centrifuges, which do the separation. Plutonium is a different chemical element, and it is produced by beginning with uranium in the fuel element, bombarding it with a neutron, turning it into the next element in the periodic table, which is neptunium. Neptunium then decays into plutonium, and lo and behold, you have plutonium. But actually, it takes a ton of uranium, irradiated uranium, to produce a half a pound of plutonium. So it's really needles in the haystack.
When plutonium was first developed, did scientists know that it could be used in weaponry?
Yes, that was an immediate thought. The minute that Seaborg discovered it in February of 1941, the first thought was, we better not tell anybody. So he submitted a paper, which was not published till 1945, and he gave it the name of plutonium because...
Well, we have neptunium. But now Pluto is no longer a planet. Maybe we should change the name.
I'd be my guest. Do we change it? I'm open. I don't care.
Did anybody think that there might be other kinds of uses for plutonium, more peaceful uses?
I don't know anybody thought there were. The only other use for plutonium I've ever heard of is to use an isotope of plutonium as an energy source for space probes.
Didn't they also put them in pacemakers for a little while?
They may have put them in pacemakers for a little while. It's basically an energy source. I think they've stopped putting them in pacemakers.
Yeah, the idea of putting something that is a form of radiation in the body seemed kind of weird.
A lot of things were weird in those days. But I think they still may use them in these very long-distance space probes. When you go beyond Mars, then you have to have something which produces energy. They still may use plutonium for that purpose.
There was a time when these sorts of things were tested on humans. Weren't small amounts of plutonium injected into people to find out what would happen?
Well, I think that was the case, and also the people at Los Alamos got injected when they certainly didn't want to. And there was a club at Los Alamos of people who had been injected involuntarily with plutonium. Which they called themselves UPPU, or UP plutonium, I think they were called. And they were tested for many, many years, and they seemed to be in fine shape, far as we know.
But people are treated with radiation, so perhaps it's just where it goes, or
yeah, it's where it goes. It's how much there is. I mean, you don't want to swallow it. And these people who got plutonium doses got it rather selectively because they had mishandling needles and things, and it doesn't seem to have done them an awful lot of harm as far as we know.
What about the byproducts of plutonium manufacture? Are they also dangerous?
Well, I don't know what byproducts you mean. I mean,
you just create this thing.
You create this thing, which is hard to get rid of, but you also create neptunium at the same time, which is has isotopes which also are fissile and are dangerous. So these fuel elements, which have the plutonium in them, are not a nice thing to have.
Well, we've talked a lot about the problems of storing nuclear waste.
Right.
But what about before? Is plutonium safe to store until it gets put into weapons, or perhaps just sits there until somebody decides not to make these kinds of weapons?
Well,
anymore?
There are two kinds of plutonium that's floating around. One is military plutonium, which is plutonium that has been separated from the uranium matrix and has been put into pits of bombs, and thousands of them are stored in places like Texas. Eventually one has to get rid of those.
And then it'll be nuclear waste? Will it be something that would be difficult to store?
Well, it's no more difficult to store than the stuff that comes out of reactors.
And that's been a problem.
Yes, so it's no less a problem. That has to be addressed. Right now it's sitting in Texas on shelves, as far as I know.
How far away is Texas from New York?
Well, it's a long walk. I think it's mainly uphill, actually. But yes, that's right. The thing that's worrisome about those is that those pits, as they're called, decay because the plutonium decays from the outside and the inside, and there's a controversy as to how long they're viable.
And what does it decay into? Another element, or just decaying plutonium?
Well, the thing that I think is concerning is that the kind that's used in the weapons are what's called the delta phase. I explained it's, but it can morph back into the alpha phase. Now the alpha phase is denser, and therefore its critical mass is smaller. So you can start with something which has a very nice non-critical mass. If it morphs into the alpha phase, then it could become critical. That's something to worry about.
Do we know if all of the countries that have nuclear weapons are have them using plutonium? India, Pakistan?
India and Pakistan use plutonium. The first Chinese bomb was a uranium bomb, interesting enough. The Russian weapons are basically all plutonium. The Chinese weapons are now plutonium. So the North Korean device was plutonium. So the element of choice is plutonium. I think the Iranians, if they make a weapon, will first make a uranium weapon. They should be stopped from doing that if possible. But the element of choice for weapons now is really plutonium.
But nuclear reactors to create energy, that is uranium?
Well, the fuel elements are uranium, but it produces in the detritus, plutonium. Globally, it produces something like 100 tons a year of it. That has to be stored.
But wait a minute. Let's stop for a second. So if I decided as the head of a country
right.
to have nuclear reactors,
correct.
Had no desire to create plutonium, I'd be creating it anyway?
Correct. There's no way you could.
Then what would I do with that? Other than
what would you do with it?
Give it to Iran.
We'll give you
sell it to Iran.
You sell it to Iran. Well, you know, or you know, somebody on the street. Well, it would come out. The fuel elements would come out, and they would have inevitably plutonium in them. When they first came out, they would be incredibly radioactive. So you would store them in a pool. In all the reactors in the United States, they're all this stuff is stored in pools. Then, if anybody had any sense, you'd have to figure out what you would then do with them. The sensible thing to do with them is to put them in glass logs, which is what the French are doing, and then bury them somewhere. Then you have to find a place to bury them.
Now, they're put in the pools to keep them cool.
they put in the pools to let them cool off and let them the radioactivity dissipate and so forth. But then you have a fuel element in a pool, and all the reactors in the United States have a lot of these fuel elements sitting in pools, and that's no way to run the railway. So the French have the same problem because 80% of their electricity is made in nuclear reactors. And what they do is they put these fuel elements in glass logs, and then they bury them somewhere, probably in the desert in Africa. We would like to bury them in Yucca Mountain, but people like Harry Reid say they won't let them because there are conditions imposed on them which are impossible to meet. They have to be safe for 10,000 years or something. So sooner or later, people will get onto this and propose more realistic conditions.
Well, in the case of Harry Reid, he's defending his home turf. In the case of the French, they're burying it in Africa, not in any part of France. Right. If somebody were to want to create a dirty bomb, they wouldn't try to find some plutonium?
No, a dirty bomb is a different story. A dirty bomb, you'd get a bunch of radioactive isotopes, get them out of a hospital, and blow them up with high explosive and scatter the radioactive material around. So that's a different kind of thing.
Jeremy Bernstein's latest book is Plutonium, A History of the World's Most Dangerous Element. It is published by Joseph Henry Press. And you say you're doing another book on nuclear weapons?
I've actually done it. It's coming out in the fall with Cambridge.
It's kind of a sister book to this?
I think it's a sister book. It deals with a general question of how you make them and what they do when they explode and all that kind of thing. So it's a sort of sister book to this one.
Now, many people know how to make them. The problem is it's difficult to do it.
It's not so difficult if you have – it's not difficult really to make a crude uranium device if you have the stuff. So the first order of business is to keep the stuff out of people's hands. That's the first order of business.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure, Leonard.